weapons that carry explosive warheads, while Star Trek's ship-mounted and handheld phasers are directed energy weapons. Star Wars' classic personal weapon, the lightsaber, cleverly combines the directed energy weapon's futuristic capacity to annihilate at a distance with the ancient practice of hand-to-hand combat. Through most of history, weapons tended to rely on kinetic energy, whether of a 20-pound rock, a 32-pound cast-iron sphere, or a 20-gram lead bullet. Tomorrow's hypervelocity tungsten rods, tall, slim, massive, fairly radar-proof, are a fearsome, though largely fictional, space-age kinetic weapon that would be discharged from a satellite. The destructive potential of these rods from God would be supplied by their gravity-accelerated descent from Earth orbit to Earth's surface. Sometimes a weapon combines kinetic energy with another kind of energy. The kinetic energy of a white phosphorus-filled exploding grenade hurled into a crowd will bruise anyone it hits. But the highly incendiary chemical energy contained within it is what will do the real damage. The kinetic energy of a long-range or intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM, that falls on a distant city will destroy a building simply by virtue of its mass and speed. But if the ICBM carries a nuclear warhead or two, as most have done since the 1960s, it can destroy entire cities. Until the space age, weapons largely depended on mass and speed to do damage to their targets. Only when space became a potential domain of warfare and lasers became the ultimate concentration of light did nearly massless energy, cheap to launch and inherently able to move at the fastest speed in the universe, become the dream weapon for the highest altitude battle zones. Lasers rank high on the wish list for a space arsenal. The laser is the quintessential directed energy weapon, a needle-thin but intensely strong beam of light that can be precisely aimed at a narrow target. While civilian versions are sufficiently mild to be used as lecture pointers, more powerful versions are used for eye surgery, cosmetic hair removal, and printing. Military versions are meant to range from highly damaging to lethal. There are also peaceable scientific lasers. One such is perched on NASA's Curiosity rover, which has been trundling across the surface of Mars since 2012. Whenever Curiosity encounters an interesting rock formation, its ChemCam laser instrument aims a series of brief million-watt pulses at it. While the laser vaporizes the target area, a camera picks up the flash and determines the chemical composition of the target, the ultimate goal being to assess the red planet's habitability. The word laser is an acronym derived from the phrase light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. And the laser has a sibling, the maser, with an M standing in for microwave. Neither occurs naturally here on Earth. Both result from the interaction of photons with specific atoms whose electrons both absorb and emit exactly the same kinds of photons. The task at hand is to generate as many of these identical photons as possible and send them out through a hole. In a laser, the photons of a single frequency accumulate in a customized cavity and are emitted in resonance with one another, with all the crests and troughs of the light waves aligned. Physicists call that state coherence, and it is singularly responsible for the focused intensity of a laser beam. Literature, specifically H.G. Wells' 1898 novel War of the Worlds, the inspiration for multiple movies and other spin-offs, was the birthplace of the laser in the form of a death-dealing beam called the heat ray, which a Martian invasionary force that lands near London pitilessly flourishes against anything and anyone in its path. The armor-clad, glob-like invaders, 100-foot-tall boilers on stilts striding along like men, wield an invisible sword of heat emitted by a camera-like generator. One soldier who has witnessed the effects of the heat ray at close range says of Britain's 12-pound guns that have been set up to repel the invaders, "It's bows and arrows against the lightning anyhow." During the decades that followed publication of War of the Worlds, especially those following the uneasy conclusion of World War I, the heat ray morphed into the more general death ray and became a recurring warrior fantasy nightmare. In 1924, during his anti-war days on the back bench, Winston Churchill warned, in a widely reprinted magazine article, that among the weapons in a coming war would be electrical rays, which could paralyze the engines of motor cars, could claw down aeroplanes from the sky, and conceivably be made destructive of human life or vision. Britain's upper echelon defense planners were not immune to the seductive potential of the fantasy, and Churchill, after becoming a vocal advocate of defensive technologies, urged its implementation. A.P. Rowe, assistant to the director of the Air Ministry's Directorate of Scientific Research and himself soon to be director of the Telecommunications Research Establishment, described the British military's response. For many years, the death ray had been a hardy annual among optimistic inventors. The usual claim was that by means of a ray emanating from a secret device, known to us in the Air Ministry as a black box, the inventor had killed rabbits at short distances, and if only he were given time and money, particularly money, he would produce a bigger and better ray which would destroy any object, such as an aircraft, onto which the ray was directed. Inventors, invariably, wanted some of the taxpayers' money before there could be any discussion of their ideas. The ministry solved the problem by offering £1,000 to any owner of a black box who could demonstrate the killing of a sheep at 100 yards, the secret to remain with its owner. The mortality rate of sheep was not affected by this offer. Interest in a death ray persisted nonetheless. With radio wave transmissions and the electrification of the world's cities proceeding apace, Henry Wimparis, Rowe's superior at the Directorate of Scientific Research, wrote that he was confident that one of the coming things will be the transmission by radiation of large amounts of electric energy along clearly directed channels. If this is correct, the use of such transmissions for the purpose of war is inevitable. The assumption was that radio waves would provide the energy, and so Wimparis asked radio researcher Robert Watson Watt in mid-January 1935 to come up with an answer to what Rowe describes as the problem of whether it was possible to concentrate in an electromagnetic beam sufficient energy to melt the metal structure of an aircraft or incapacitate the crew. Avoiding any reference to planes or people, Watson Watt handed the problem to an underling, Arnold Wilkins, asking him in a scribbled note to calculate the amount of radio frequency power which should be radiated to raise the temperature of 8 pints of water from 98 degrees Fahrenheit to 105 degrees Fahrenheit at a distance of 5 kilometers and at a height of 1 kilometer. As 8 pints is the amount of blood in an average adult human male, Wilkins wasn't fooled by the obfuscation. It seemed clear to me that the note concerned the production of fever heat in an airman's blood by a death ray, and I supposed that Watson Watt's opinion had been sought about the possibility of producing such a ray. My calculation showed, as expected, that a huge power would have to be generated at any radio frequency to produce a fever in the pilot of an aircraft, It was clear that no radio death ray was possible. But Wilkins suggested another idea to Watson Watt, exploiting an earlier discovery by a couple of radio engineers that metal airplanes invariably interfered with radio communication. That interference, he said, amounted to an announcement of their presence, even when they couldn't be seen. Watson Watt rushed off a memo to Wimperis, omitting the fact that Wilkins had supplied the information. Thus was born the concept of radar. Was the death ray dead? No, only the radio death ray. As Rowe opined in 1948, the idea of a death ray, however, was not absurd, and something of the kind may come within 100 years. And so it has. While astrophysical lasers are a rarity, astrophysical masers are semi-common. You can find one variety deep within colossal gas clouds scattered across spiral galaxies. In dense, bright, star-forming regions within those clouds, countless electrons that belong to molecules of hydroxyl OH or water H2O or ammonia NH3 are primed to emit resonant photons. Picture a large cavity within a blob of gas. Now picture the light from nearby stars bathing the region. The photons get absorbed by selected molecules. What happens next is part of the weird world of quantum mechanics. The same bath of photons that the molecules absorbed stimulates those same molecules to emit photons of the same wavelength, the same energy, mostly in the microwave part of the spectrum. Excite a gas with microwaves, the molecules of gas emit microwaves. The microwaves cause the molecules to emit more microwaves. Next, the microwave energy punches through the cloud, creating a powerful, concentrated beam that funnels out in one direction. Behold, an astrophysical maser, aimed wherever the opening in the cloud happens to face. Unlike their astrophysical relatives, human-made lasers must be pointed with exactitude. Bad aim brings disaster. A common ground-based military-grade 30-kilowatt laser, with its 6 million times the power of an ordinary laser pointer, can punch a hole in a truck engine or in the fuel tank of a booster rocket sitting on a launch pad. Space-based lasers, once perfected, would be dominant and lethal. Deployment presents challenges, however. While in motion around Earth, the laser must generate and direct colossal power to a specific target, which is also in motion. What's more, the laser beam must be delivered swiftly, unattenuated by clouds and unmolested by atmospherics. Coming up with the initial power is the first step, and there are many possible sources. A common chemical laser, for instance, depends on the conversion of stored chemical energy into intense infrared energy, harnessing the energy of molecules that are zealously engaged in a chemical reaction and then channeling that energy into a beam of light. A less benign option would be a small nuclear bomb or nuclear reactor investigated in the 1970s and 1980s for use in weapons such as the space-based X-ray lasers of the failed U.S. missile defense program Project Excalibur. Once the energy has been produced, you need a cavity of some kind that will hold and ideally further stimulate the already hyped-up molecules. A recent development is the fiber laser, in which extremely long, hair-thin, light-transmitting glass or plastic fibers, saturated with rare earth elements, are the operative technology. Notable attributes of this kind of laser include its potential to offer huge amounts of power and to be bent into a compact shape. Furthermore, it's stable at high temperatures, and the inherent light wave guiding properties of a fiber produce an extremely precise, intense beam. Once you've got the power, the medium, and the beam, you face the challenge of aiming. For that, you'll need an optical apparatus capable of high resolution so that the target area can be clearly seen. Does that sound like a telescope? It should, because it is. Today, the largest optics, mirrors rather than lenses, are the ones developed for telescopes. Early in the 21st century, a comprehensive report from the RAND Corporation, a think tank devoted mainly to U.S. military policy, proposed that the optics required for a space-based laser weapon designed to destroy terrestrial targets could become available and affordable once the optics required for the next-generation space telescope had been mastered. Today's real-life next-generation space telescope, the 7-ton James Webb Space Telescope, has a 6.5-meter gold-coated mirror made up of 18 separate hexagonal segments constructed from pure beryllium, a metal that's both strong and light. But all that high design doesn't come close to the report's estimate of what would be needed for a space-to-Earth laser. A mirror measuring more than 10 meters across, millions of watts of available power, and the capacity to withstand overwhelming heat. After all is said and done, according to RAND's researchers, much more progress would have to happen before a space-based laser becomes feasible, let alone reasonable. Many other analysts arrived at the same position, including a few years later the authors of a report from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, who concluded that the technology for a usable laser of this sort does not currently exist and will not for the foreseeable future. Even the people who themselves develop directed energy technologies or oversee the acquisition of these technologies for the Department of Defense now cite time frames such as the 2020s for the first flight test of an aircraft-mounted 60 to 150 kilowatt laser. In other words, space-based, long-distance, million-watt laser weapons remain the stuff of fantasy. Aware of this mismatch between needs and expectations, RAND offered an interim solution. Laser weapons aimed at space could be located on high, dry mountaintops down here on Earth. Yes, but those mountaintops happen to be the very places where we astrophysicists like to put our telescopes. Shouldn't be a problem, said the researchers. Just put the weapon and the science in the same location, since both groups use laser beams to monitor and correct for atmospheric turbulence in their observations. The scientists might even welcome the laser if its large optics could also be used to increase observing time when not needed for weapon operations, maintenance, or training, said RAND. Given that astro folk tend to be a peaceable crew, except might be a more suitable word than welcome. Since its founding in 1948, by the way, the RAND Corporation has supported a fair bit of thinking about the unthinkable. To this and other ends, it has consistently hired impressive individuals ranging from Daniel Ellsberg, who made public the Pentagon Papers, to Donald Rumsfeld, who served as a RAND trustee for a quarter century before becoming George W. Bush's Secretary of Defense. RAND's very first report, commissioned by Major General Curtis LeMay and published in 1946, bears the exciting sci-fi title, Preliminary Design of an Experimental World-Circling Spaceship, i.e. a satellite, and its very first client was the Air Force. In 1958, a RAND author, Robert W. Buckheim, produced a classified space tutorial, The Space Handbook, for the enlightenment of the House Select Committee on Astronautics and Space Exploration. The following year, Buckheim and the RAND staff updated and declassified the handbook for publication by Random House. and by the beginning of the 21st century, RAND had generated hundreds of policy papers on space science, space exploration, and space warfare. Speaking on national radio and television in late March 1983, halfway through his first term of office, President Ronald Reagan drew an alarming picture of the defunding and decay of U.S. military forces and military technology during the 1970s, in contrast to the USSR's concurrent military buildup. According to Reagan, the imbalance was overwhelming and terrifying. For 20 years, the Soviet Union has been accumulating enormous military might. They didn't stop when their forces exceeded all requirements of a legitimate defensive capability, and they haven't stopped now. During the past decade and a half, the Soviets have built up a massive arsenal of new strategic nuclear weapons, weapons that can strike directly at the United States. With U.S. military spending overdue for a major boost, the president was publicly announcing a new initiative to counter the awesome Soviet missile threat with measures that are defensive. He first posed a rhetorical question. What if free people could live secure in the knowledge that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies? He then called for the scientific community in our country, those who gave us nuclear weapons, to turn their great talents now to the cause of mankind and world peace, to give us the means of rendering these nuclear weapons impotent and obsolete. In its report on the speech, the New York Times relayed statement from White House officials who said that the new program might involve lasers, microwave devices, particle beams, and projectile beams, all of which, though still in a very early stage of development, would be capable, in theory, of being directed from satellites, airplanes, or land-based installations to shoot down missiles in the air. The administration's vision of missile defense was formally called the Strategic Defense Initiative, or SDI. But given the release of the third film in the Star Wars trilogy 2 months after Reagan's speech, a colloquial rename was irresistible, and SDI was dubbed Star Wars. Its primary goal was to destroy a nuclear-tipped ICBM in the course of its swift journey in our direction, preferably soon after launch. It was to be a matter of interception, knocking out the other side's missile well before it reached our side and knocked us out. That's quite a technical challenge, often and accurately described as a bullet hitting a bullet. Richard L. Garwin, a renowned physicist whose military work has ranged from the hydrogen bomb to spy satellites, warned that if the missile carried 100 targeted bomblets rather than just one big bomb, an interception during the terminal phase, the release of all the bomblets, would fail. A successful interception could be done earlier, he added, up to about 4 minutes into the boost phase, if and only if the interceptor issued from somewhere nearby. Burton Richter, recipient of the 1976 Nobel Prize for Physics, declared, "The intercept in space hit-to-kill system now under development is the most technically challenging of the possible alternatives. The proposed system is not ready to graduate from development to deployment and probably never will be." Journalists echoed the skepticism. In a piece about one SDI concept, Brilliant Pebbles, tens of thousands of small, smart orbiting rockets that would hurl 10-pound projectiles at incoming enemy ICBMs, fatally puncturing them, John M. Broder, then at the Los Angeles Times, wrote, "Any space-based anti-missile system confronts a difficult technological task. To identify ballistic missiles in the very early stages of flight, to pick out the rocket body from its large plume of fire, to track and then home in on the target before the weapons-carrying bus separates and releases the nuclear warheads. Nevertheless, beginning in the 1950s, while Ronald Reagan was still a Hollywood actor, both the USA and the USSR conducted considerable R&D on missile defense, pausing briefly in acquiescence to the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, but picking up again within a few years. During the decade that followed Reagan's announcement, Congress put $30 billion into the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization. In 1993, describing how well that money was spent, the organization's director, General James A. Abramson, said it had yielded major hardware assembly and field experiments necessary to prove available technologies can be integrated together to operate as an effective defensive system in a hostile and reactive environment, and had caused a sea change in our negotiations with the former Soviet Union and, by informed and authoritative accounts, the end of the Cold War. Indeed, claimed he, the evaporation of the need for Cold War spending had more than repaid the $30 billion investment of the past decade in just a couple of years. Meanwhile, large quantities of sober analysis, concerned commentary, damning survey results, and carefully worded petitions, much of it issuing from Nobel laureates and other unassailable experts such as Richard Garwin and Carl Sagan, who felt obliged to demolish Star Wars precepts, politics, and prospects, were rapidly accumulating. Possibly swayed by the scale of the opposition, Congress periodically reduced SDI funding and attached strings to it. The Pentagon responded by classifying information on the costs of SDI. Problem is, when more than 90% of the 450 physicists, engineers, and mathematicians in the National Academy of Sciences who answer a 1986 Cornell University questionnaire on SDI say that the technology would be unable to effectively defend the U.S. population against a Soviet missile strike, and when 1,400 scientists and engineers currently or formerly at government and industrial laboratories send a letter to Congress declaring their serious concerns about SDI and their belief that its stated goal is not feasible in the foreseeable future and represents a significant escalation of the arms race, and when more than 3,800 senior faculty members of physics, computer science, and other hard science departments at leading U.S. universities, including almost 60% of all faculty in America's top 20 physics departments, sign a pledge to reject funding from the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization, that's when it becomes hard to tout the achievements of SDI unless you're the guy in charge. Even some scientists who were doing the actual research told Senate staffers in 1986 that there had been no major breakthroughs that would make comprehensive deployment possible by the late 1990s. In November 1987, 3 weeks before a Reagan-Gorbachev summit, a group called Space Watch organized a debate titled, "Is the Strategic Defense Initiative in the National Interest?" in which Sagan and Garwin spoke against the emergent non-Reaganesque version of SDI, while General Abramson and Richard Perle, then an Assistant Secretary of Defense, spoke in his favor. The former pair offered physics and logic. The latter offered primarily politics and fear, plus a couple of superficially reasonable statements, such as the validity of attempting a partial defense if a comprehensive defense proved unachievable. In his opening remarks, Sagan points out that there are almost 60,000 nuclear weapons in the world, more than a third of them designed to go from the homeland of one nation to the homeland of another. Since the world has only 2,300 cities of 100,000 people or more, there is obviously a grotesque disproportionality between the power of the nuclear arsenals of the United States and the Soviet Union and any conceivable use. Having established the degree of nuclear peril, Sagan goes on to say that because Reagan's promise of population defense would be so hard to achieve, SDI's champions have given in to the temptation to shift the ground to invent more modest objectives. So, SDI is fine if it is perfect. That is, if no significant number of Soviet warheads leaks through the shield. The most optimistic numbers you can hear from technically competent advocates of Star Wars is 70, 80, or maybe even 90% of incoming Soviet warheads destroyed. Well, take the more optimistic number. If 90% are destroyed, 10% get through. 10% of, say, 10,000 warheads is 1,000 warheads. 1,000 warheads is much more than is needed to obliterate the United States. The shield is leaky. Well, Star Wars has survived the decades, even though major components have been abandoned, postponed, reframed, or scaled back. Both Brilliant Pebbles and a space-based nuclear-pumped X-ray laser called Project Excalibur were canceled in the early 1990s. By then, some commentators maintain, SDI had effectively served a central Cold War purpose, the further weakening of the Soviet economy. That space-based missile defense was largely unachievable was beside the point. If the Soviets could be convinced it was achievable, they would pour money they barely had into trying to make it happen. As Gorbachev's military advisor told Soviet studies specialist Dmitry Symes in 1990, while SDI was unlikely to achieve its stated goal of serving as an impenetrable barrier against nuclear attack, it was nevertheless a full-scale military technical offensive planned simultaneously to overcome Moscow militarily and ruin the USSR financially. Within a few months after 9/11, the Strategic Defense Initiative became the Missile Defense Agency and was exempted from the Pentagon's standard procurement and oversight procedures. February 2010 marked a modest milestone. The first lethal boost phase intercept, with both weapon and target in motion, a megawatt-level laser mounted on a plane, destroyed a ballistic missile at close range within 2 minutes after the missile's launch. By 2017, Star Wars had barely made it past the concept stage. As the world witnessed a flurry of North Korean missile successes, accompanied by a volley of insults exchanged between the U.S. and North Korean heads of state, a land-based U.S. missile defense installation broke ground in South Korea. So, for the time being, the armed forces will have to do without orbiting laser weapons. Asteroids, large rocks, and even larger rock piles held together by gravity, may present other military possibilities. Some are the size of cars, others the size of houses, still others the size of stadiums. The largest are the size of mountains. From time to time, these cosmic missiles have hit and obliterated entire regions of Earth. Many more have come close but not hit us. A good solution to the danger would be to identify the trajectories of such objects and destroy or deflect any that threaten to hit us. The first step is to find them and their cometary brethren, together classified as near-Earth objects or NEOs. For good reason, space organizations around the world have prioritized finding and tracking NEOs. Celestial Mechanics decrees that any NEO whose path crosses Earth's orbit will strike Earth sometime within the next 100 million years or so. Size matters. By now, the NEO catalog lists more than 16,000, about 1,000 of which are larger than a kilometer across, large enough to disrupt civilization. Yet size isn't the whole story. What about NEOs that might strike in the next 1,000 years, the next century, or the next decade? A threatening subset of NEOs known as PHAs, short for potentially hazardous asteroids, harbor a high probability of swooping within about 20 times the Earth-Moon distance during the next century. But maybe there's an asteroid with Earth's name on it that isn't yet known. If found and tracked, it must then either be destroyed or forced into another path. And that part of the challenge persists. In the 1990s, when NASA was about to begin surveying the skies for near-Earth asteroids that measured more than a kilometer across and that might be heading our way, the most efficient available technology for deflection would have been a series of multi-megaton nuclear explosions. At that time, Carl Sagan and his colleague Stephen Ostro of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory saw grave dangers inherent in both the survey, known as Space Guard, and the deflection technology. If we can perturb an asteroid out of impact trajectory, it follows that we can also transform one on a benign trajectory into an Earth impactor. With a Space Guard-like inventory of such asteroids and launch-ready deflection system of nuclear-armed missiles, it might take only a few years to identify a suitably large asteroid, alter its orbit with a series of nuclear explosions, and send it crashing into Earth. Thus, a few nuclear weapons could by themselves threaten the global civilization. The two scientists were also concerned that in the real world, and in light of well-established human frailty and fallibility, knowledge could too easily be turned from a tool of protection into a tool of destruction. Given 20th century history and present global politics, it is hard to imagine guarantees against eventual misuse of an asteroid deflection system commensurate with the dangers such a system poses. Those who argue that it would be prudent to prevent catastrophic impacts with annual probabilities of 10 to the negative 5 will surely recognize the prudence of preventing more probable catastrophes of comparable magnitude from misuse of a potentially apocalyptic technology. A decade later, focusing not on the prevention, but rather on the creation of catastrophe, RAND researchers studied the feasibility, relative costs, and psychology of turning asteroids into weapons. They concluded that since much cheaper, more responsive weapons of mass destruction are readily available, this one is likely to remain safely in the realm of science fiction. If deploying an actual asteroid against an enemy is infeasible, we still face the problem of rendering an incoming one harmless to ourselves. Two 1998 blockbuster movies, Deep Impact and Armageddon, solved that problem by nuking their NEOs. In the domain of nonfiction, too, a few investigators have been assessing the possibility of having a spacecraft set off a nuclear explosion deep within the unwelcome space rock thereby yielding scads of unwelcome orbital debris, but nukes could be used for deflection, not merely destruction. For instance, you could deploy one to create a proximal explosion near one side of an asteroid, causing a recoil by the asteroid and thus forcing a change in its orbit. Misuse of a potentially apocalyptic technology was the specter raised by Sagan and Ostro, a perspective that matters to us all, whether or not asteroids are the subject. But even a technological glitch or a minor accident could lead to an apocalyptic event. Safety mechanisms have prevented most such outcomes, but no real-life mechanisms are foolproof, infallible, or always applicable. The Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima nuclear disasters made that clear. In July 1961, the nuclear reactor on a Soviet submarine, stationed not far from a NATO base in the North Atlantic, developed a disastrous leak in its cooling system. The engineering crew managed to rig a substitute coolant arrangement and prevent a nuclear explosion, but within 3 weeks, those engineers had all died of ionizing radiation. Today, Pravda is on record saying that if the reactor had in fact exploded, it could have triggered World War III. In September 1980, during routine maintenance on a nuclear-tipped Titan II missile far underground in rural Arkansas, a socket that was inadvertently dropped from a wrench punctured the missile. This damage caused a fuel leak, leading to the collapse and explosion of the entire apparatus. It could also have led to the inadvertent detonation of the 9-megaton nuclear warhead perched atop the missile, resulting in the destruction of practically everything and everyone from Little Rock to New York City. But by pure dumb luck, the nose cone that housed the warhead blew apart during the explosion, separating the warhead from its source of electricity. Without electricity, its detonators wouldn't work. That was just one U.S. accident, and there have been thousands. Besides glitches and accidents involving deadly technology, there's the fact that benign technology can be adapted to serve apocalyptic ends. Dual-use space hardware, which dominates the world of space assets, can serve either military or civilian purposes. And dual-use can slip into misuse. Even a kindly little weather satellite can be reprogrammed, repurposed, and deployed as a platform to support weapons of mass destruction. On the other hand, a solar sail cannot redirect a threatening asteroid on short notice. Nor can an app for identifying new asteroids solve the problem of deflection. Mapping the paths of space rocks is not the same as moving them. You'd still need a way to eliminate the danger, whether by destruction or deflection, plus sufficient lead time to make it happen. Are there any non-scary proposals for planetary defense? Yes. Current consensus favors the gravitational tractor. Park a massive space probe beside the offending Neo. Although their mutual gravity gently urges them toward each other, station-keeping retro rockets on the probe preserve the gap. The space probe slowly draws the asteroid out of its deadly path, yielding no debris at all. Enough hypotheticals. What's in the real-life readily available space arsenal? Surely there are X-ray lasers, high-power microwave beams, hyper-velocity metal rods, miniature autonomous attack space planes with self-adapting warheads, space-based smart munitions, nuclear electromagnetic pulse warheads designed to be detonated at high altitudes, co-orbital ASATs, weaponized microsatellites, orbiting battle stations? Nope. Definitions of space weapons vary. Here are two. 1. Terrestrially based devices specifically designed and flight tested to physically attack, impair, or destroy objects in space, or space-based devices designed and flight tested to attack, impair, or destroy objects in space or on Earth. And 2. Attack munitions that are themselves orbital objects or that are intended to destroy space objects. What's actually available? Kinetic or explosive interceptor missiles and tactical modest kilowatt lasers. That's it. They can each target satellites, terrestrial installations, and long-range missiles, though that last one is still a challenge. When their task is to kill or otherwise neutralize a satellite, they're called ASATs, A for anti, SAT for satellite. Satellites would seem to be prime targets. They're central to modern life, especially the GPS constellation. And they're not easy to camouflage, so their orbits are obvious to all who look. Furthermore, geostationary satellites, such as those used for nearly all space-based communications, are always present at the same altitude above the same places on our planet, hence geo plus stationary. At 36,000 kilometers up, they're the highest orbiting class of satellites, but present an especially easy target for evildoers. For societies and militaries that depend heavily on global positioning, communications, surveillance, navigation, early warning, and weather satellites, and no society or military is more dependent on them than America's, an attack on our space assets would be terrifying. Precisely because of the world's growing dependence on satellites, ASATs work best as a threat. To visit intentional doom upon someone else's satellite spells retaliatory doom for one's own. Although, in fact, the United States would suffer more from a successful hit than would its adversaries. ASATs, like so many other elements of contemporary military thinking and technology, have taproots in the Cold War when threat inflation held sway at the Pentagon. In tandem with their earliest work on satellites, both the USA and the USSR actively pursued anti-satellite weapons. By 1962, the United States had produced interceptors fitted with nuclear warheads. By 1968, the Soviet Union had carried out the first successful test of a non-nuclear kinetic kill interceptor. During the next few decades, while continually voicing anxiety over each other's ASAT tests, the two sides kept designing and sometimes building ASATs based on land, sea, and air, as well as an anti-satellite orbital station or two. Although many of these weapons were eventually abandoned or mothballed for political and self-protective reasons, a mutually soothing policy that some political scientists call contingent restraint, the planning and execution continued in a whirl of simultaneous escalation and de-escalation, confrontation and quasi-cooperation, anxieties and pullbacks. Finally, in August 1983, 5 months after Reagan's Star Wars speech, as certain members of Congress were working up legislation aimed at achieving a joint U.S.-Soviet moratorium, Yuri Andropov, General Secretary of the Soviet Communist Party, met with a bipartisan delegation of 9 U.S. senators in Moscow and committed the Soviet Union to a moratorium on the deployment of any new ASAT systems in space, even for testing purposes. The United States did not follow suit. In October 1985, an American ASAT, a small missile launched from an F-15 fighter jet, took out an aged American scientific satellite, spreading debris throughout low Earth orbit. By the way, the Soviet Union regarded America's space shuttle as a possible ASAT. National Security Specialist Joan Johnson Fries suggests they feared its robotic arm, which might pluck satellites out of the sky. UK military space specialist Matthew Mouthorpe proposes instead that the Soviets feared its possible cargo of nuclear missiles. One of the more imaginative ASAT designs was the Kinetic Energy Anti-Satellite, KE-ASAT, interceptor, birthed in the United States. It would not only smash into and destroy its target satellite, but also envelop the resulting space debris in a giant Teflon sheet. Notwithstanding the unlikelihood of this environmentally tidy outcome, KE-ASAT has not completely disappeared from America's portfolio. Nor has the ASAT as a category disappeared from the global arsenal. The United States, under the banner of safeguarding its extensive space assets, continues to invest far more heavily than any other country in anti-satellite research and development. Other countries, too, are pursuing the ASAT. Russia tested one in November 2015. Israel and India are working on theirs. And North Korea keeps demonstrating how fiercely it wants one and how close it is to getting what it wants. The most striking demonstrations of ASAT power in recent years, however, were carried out on their very own satellites by China, 2007, and the United States, 2008. Let's say you want to harm a satellite or, at a minimum, be recognized as capable of doing so. Harm covers a lot of tactical territory, ranging from temporary disruption to obliteration. Moving lethal levels of energy across the distances inherent in space warfare is still a stretch. Even if you could do it, tomahawking an enemy satellite out of the sky would be as expensive and dangerous to your own and your allies' space assets as it would be to those of your enemies. Deploying a missile from an airborne platform would be easier and less expensive, but would make no less of a mess in space. Simple disruption seems the way to go. If you've got a strong enough laser, you could focus it at the satellite's circuit box or transmission antenna, which would disable the satellite completely and cheaply with no muss or fuss. Or how about swamping the satellite's sensors with a laser brighter than whatever the satellite might be trying to monitor or record? An act of high-tech vandalism called dazzling. If your laser is energetic enough, you could even melt, evaporate, or fracture parts of the satellite's sensor, partially blinding it. You could also consider having your own spacecraft sidle up to the enemy's satellite and spray paint its optics or physically break its antenna. A cheaper, easier approach to disruption, at least until quantum satellites take over, would be to interfere with satellite communications either cybernetically or electronically. A powerful Earth-based transmitter tuned to the right frequencies can compete with the signal that an enemy receiver needs to receive. That transmitter could drown out the enemy's real signal with meaningless noise, otherwise known as jamming, or mimic the real signal with a fake one of similar power, otherwise known as spoofing. In these cases, there's no need to destroy anything, as you turn the transmitter into a useless hunk of junk. Strictly speaking, your jammer or spoofer would not be classified as a space weapon, nor would the interventions of a hacker. Plus, most of the measures we've mentioned could be accomplished more readily and cheaply from land, sea, or air than from an orbiting platform. In the end, of course, carrying out any of these attacks risks retaliation in kind. What, then, is the status of the arsenal for a space war? Modern warfare can be fought on so many delightfully different levels. says the creepy Baron Verdorko in the sci-fi classic Babel 17. Yes, there's a cornucopia of imaginary choices. Directed mass, directed energy, chemical, biological, electronic, nuclear, cyber, terrestrial, submarine, aerial, orbital, parasitical, face-to-face, close range, remote controlled, robotic, boost phase, mid-course, targeted, carpeted, smart, dumb. But the space weaponry piece of this picture has little to do with actual warfare. It's mostly about threat and deterrence. It's about potential, power, perceived and projected superiority. Nonetheless, warfighters and national security planners everywhere will not stop trying to actualize the imaginary. Given the many human-made threats to human life and property, the General Assembly of the United Nations has, among its many other frustrating endeavors, struggled since the dawn of the space age to establish rules of the road for achieving freedom of scientific investigation and international cooperation in the exploration and use of outer space, and to keep outer space free of weapons in order to avert a grave danger for international peace and security. Within a few decades, the United Nations also began to tangle with the mounting problems of space debris and global space security. Some might say such efforts are naive, that whoever owns space assets should take charge of protecting them, that the militarization of space in the interests of protecting one's assets is inevitable, that one unbalanced person in power can undo any space agreements the community of nations has adopted. Others might reply that everybody's space assets would be far more vulnerable if there were no international agreements or resolutions in place, if there were no collective effort to preserve what we each separately have. As James Clay Moltz, a specialist in matters of conflict, nuclear and otherwise, points out, unilateral military approaches to space security can go only so far. Fear of retaliation and the costs of escalation constrain most unilateralists. Diplomacy is one of the few paths forward. However arbitrary it may seem to name a starting date and place for the intricacies of space diplomacy, let's go with October 4, 1954, at a planning meeting of the International Council of Scientific Unions in Rome. There, they conceived and planned for the first ever and only ever International Geophysical Year. Oddly, it was to span a year and a half, from July 1957 through December 1958. IGY represented a Cold War thawing of frozen scientific interchange concerning oceanography, seismology, glaciology, meteorology, solar activity, and related topics. 67 countries collaborated on IGY, including the United States and the Soviet Union. At that meeting, the U.S. representatives proposed that satellites equipped with observation instruments be launched during IGY. Historian Walter A. McDougall writes that, shortly after the end of World War II, observation reconnaissance satellites topped U.S. space thinkers' wish lists, but that such satellites could not have been more delicate from the standpoints of international law, diplomacy, and strategy. Only a scientific satellite could neatly embody the principle of freedom of space. The Americans called it open skies. And so, the IGY proposal, made in an international context, amounted to a fortuitous match between need and opportunity. Though the Soviet representatives contributed no comments regarding the U.S. proposal, the committee as a whole unanimously welcomed it. Their approval pulled back the hammer